We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Or evening or morning, whichever time people are listening to this, since it does air on three different times on our little outpost. All right, so starting out with the week's news and local, starting out with a ruling that was made evident this week by the OPA regarding SPD.
Yeah, the OPA, the Office of Police Accountability, is inside.
No, it's actually Professional Accountability.
No, that was the old name. They changed it to the Office of Police Accountability, and it's housed inside the Seattle Police Department, not external to the department. They ruled this week that Seattle police officer Noah Zeck was in the right when he shot and killed Sean Feuer last April. Feuer's ex called the police last April and told them that Feuer was drunk. He had beaten her and stolen their young child from Rainier Playfield. She also told them that Feuer had a gun with him. When a SWAT team located Feuer, he fled on foot with the child in his arms. Police eventually cornered him, and within seconds, Zeck shot him in the head while he was still holding his daughter. Police then discovered that there was no gun on Feuer, that he had either left it somewhere in the interim or had never had it on him in the first place. The OPA determined from the body cam video that Zeck couldn't see Fuhrer's right hand, and so Zeck was therefore justified in killing him because he believed Fuhrer might be carrying a gun, right? So
if he was carrying a baby, how was he supposed to have his hands up?
Yeah, so Fuhrer was not pointing a gun at Zeck, clearly, because he couldn't see his right hand. He was not running towards him. He was actually trying to flee. And he wasn't brandishing a gun because his right hand was hidden, okay? He was holding his daughter, obviously. We know that. And he was black, which is also a fact in the case. And Zeck is white. In an indication of how bad this really is, Fuhrer's ex is now threatening to sue the Seattle Police Department because they killed Fuhrer instead of apprehending him, as she feels they should have done and would have done if he'd been a white man. Now, Brandy Grant, the executive...
She's got a point.
Yes, she does. Brandy Grant, the executive director of the Community Police Commission, Seattle's civilian oversight board, which is external to the Seattle Police Department, wrote in a press release this week, quote, "We are heartbroken for Sean Feuer's loved ones and our entire community. This is a tragedy on every level. Police responses in Seattle too often result in violence, particularly when it involves people of color. We cannot continue to rely on police policy that has repeatedly allowed officers to shoot unarmed people. In no world should it be acceptable to shoot someone when they have their baby in their arms." The community Police Commission then said that it will be following up to try to get the case files in this case and review some of the evidence that the OPA also looked at. This really points to the big problem with the OPA, I think. 9 of its 11 investigators are sworn police officers, so there's a lot of leeway granted to officers who are being interviewed when they say that they saw or were thinking something when they shot someone. In addition, the OPA is only supposed to review these cases against the Seattle Police Department's use of force policy and training guidelines, and those have been shaped by the Seattle Police Department's bargaining agreements with the two police unions, including the expired Seattle Police Officers Guild contract that rolled back reforms to the police disciplinary process that had been passed into law by the city council.
Can I back up to your previous point about the officer's testimony?
Sure.
That testimony is coached by the union, by SPOG. So when officers have a lot of time to prepare that testimony, they're not interviewed right away, obviously. So were they're just reviewing the files when the department interviewed them, which also is not right away. And that gives the union plenty of time to coach an officer on how to tell a story. I don't think that's a reliable narrative.
Like we say, the OPA gives a lot of leeway to what officers say they were thinking and whether or not they felt threatened at the time that they fired their weapon.
Yeah,
because it's essentially one SPD officer interviewing another, right?
Yeah, and that's not sworn testimony either.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to point out too, the OPA is reviewing this against the Seattle Police Department's use of force policy, right? And we know there are problems with the use of force policy. It's currently being revised because of problems with their crowd control techniques. Three oversight bodies, the OPA, the CPC, and the Office of Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department have all issued reports on problems that they found in the use of force policy and changes that they think should be made. But it's really clear here, too, that there are still issues of racial bias that have to be addressed within the Seattle Police Department and within their training, and that the Seattle Police Department still has a ways to go in that regard.
Nicely understated.
I was going to say, that's a very long and winding road.
Maybe a mild statement for saying that hey, you know, there are some officers who are racist or who need a heck of a lot of training in order to bring them up to speed on how to treat people of color.
All right. Let's, while we're on the subject of law enforcement, bounce over to developments with Pierce County Sheriff Ed Troyer.
Yeah. The Pierce County Council met this week to consider the sad case of Sheriff Ed Troyer, who it emerged this month back in January. He called 911. And said that he saw a young black man going from door to door and that the man had threatened his life. Well, you know, there was a police response, as you might imagine, and it turned out the 24-year-old black man was a newspaper carrier who was delivering from door to door because that's what newspaper carriers do at 4 in the morning. And as soon as Pierce County investigators talked with Troyer, he walked back his story and said that the young man had not threatened him at all, that he'd had no contact, in fact, with man. So this has led to a number of calls for him to resign, as you might imagine. And the Pierce County Council, in a profile of courage, decided instead to hire an independent investigator. Not clear where that investigator is going to come from. Since almost, you know, unless you're going to hire a PI, which seems unlikely, you know, it's almost certainly going to be another law enforcement agency. Meanwhile, he remains on the job. And this has outraged a lot of people in Pierce County. So, yes, SPD is far from the only law enforcement agency in the region with a race problem. And once again, holding such people accountable seems to be a problem, given that, really all the investigator needs to do is look at the notes from Troyer's discussion with the Pierce County Sheriff's investigator he talked with, because he's already walked back that and listened to the dispatch call, because he's already walked back his initial story. It doesn't seem like any of the facts are in dispute in that case, in other words.
Yeah, and when you're caught lying, that's usually something that would make say your supervisor consider firing you, right? If you're a member of law enforcement.
Yeah,
so when you have the top guy doing that, what kind of a precedent does that set for the whole department?
Exactly. And, you know, when they do fire him, which will probably happen at some point, it will probably be for lying rather than for the dispatch call and, you know, sticking in the cops on the young black man who was just doing his job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So.
Okay. Let's talk about election news. This week in Seattle, perennial crank candidate Kate Martin has jumped into the mayor's race and the race for city council position 8 against Teresa Mosqueda. Now,
why
I'm
not
thinking,
position 9 as well? And city attorney.
Exactly.
She's not an attorney, but, you know, why not?
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking any day now she's going to file for city attorney, too. You know, it's actually not unusual for a minor candidate to declare that they're running for the city council, but then not tell you which seat they're actually filing for until closer to the deadline. But nobody has filed in both a specific city council race and the mayor's race simultaneously before. But hey, you know,
I'm thinking that's a really, really dangerous precedent for people like Stan Lipman, Mike the Mover.
Right. You know, Kate Martin kind of lives in her own world where anything's possible. So who knows what she's thinking exactly in the race for council.
Maybe she did it by mistake.
Well, she might have, because apparently she filed the same paperwork twice for city council position 8. So there may be some cognitive issues going on there as well. Now, in the race for city council position 8, incumbent Teresa Mosqueda now has 4 challengers, and all 4 of them are what we might consider perennial crank candidates. And that includes Alex Zimmerman, David Ishii, Kate Martin, and Paul Glumaz, who appears to be a LaRouche. So yes, although Lyndon LaRouche is long gone now, his followers still stumble on like zombies.
He'll be coming back. He'll be coming back.
Yes, they're still out there. Must seek office. Must seek office. Yeah.
Must be campaign. Must be fresh.
Yes. In the mayor's race, the minor candidates now outnumber the major candidates. They include socialist worker Henry Dennison, the Reverend Rodney Holt, who doesn't seem like a bad guy, but I don't think has a prayer of getting up into the major candidate list. Red Basher Asuka Jax, who ran a failed campaign against Shama Sawant in 2019. Mona Radishwar, who uses a marijuana leaf icon in her campaign materials and is campaigning to end the war on drugs. Matthew
Irvin. You know, that might get some votes.
Oh, yeah, it might, yeah. Matthew Irvin, whose slogan is Make Seattle Great Again. I'm just kind of waiting for him to roll out the green hats. Green for the Emerald City. Jeffrey Applegate.
He's probably not that imaginative.
No.
And he'll just tell people to wear their old Trump hats.
Yeah, there you go. And Jeffrey Applegate, who appears to be campaigning only on Reddit and then only on one Reddit message stream. And Thomas W. Kennis, about whom I could find almost nothing online except a LinkedIn listing for a self-employed IT manager who may or may not be him. And then car salesman William Kopetich, who was one of the first filers in the race, has now withdrawn. There are still 15 candidates in the race for mayor. 7 of them we might consider serious or top tier candidates. And I wanted to take a look at how the serious or top tier candidates rank when it comes to raising money. Because if you're able to raise a lot of money right out of the gate, that bodes well for your campaign if you're running a citywide race. So here's the breakdown.
Especially since you know, a lot of these candidates, some of them have name recognition, some of them do not. The ones that do not pretty much have to be able to raise money out of the gate. However, in a crowded field like that, it only takes, you know, like 15% maybe to get into the general election. So.
Yeah, so we'll see. Here's the breakdown of the 7 top candidates and how much they've raised as of March 24th, which was about Wednesday of this past week. So Colleen Echo Hawk is in the lead with $104,402. Lorena Gonzalez is behind her with $58,197. Echo Hawk's been in the race longer than Gonzalez, and notably Gonzalez has raised a lot in a short time. So just because she's about half of Echo Hawk's total is not a bad sign yet.
Yeah, although that is a very impressive total for Echo Hawk.
For Echo Hawk, yeah. And then third in the race, which might come as a surprise, is Andrew Grant Houston with about $49,000. And he's not that far behind Gonzalez. And then fourth is Jessen Farrell with about $29,000. Lance Randall is behind her with $22,629. James Donaldson, is in sixth place with $25. And then Bruce Harrell shows $0, although that's going to change next week with next week's filing, because I was looking at the list of candidates who've received democracy vouchers, and he's getting a lot of democracy vouchers. So expect that to change. Echo Hawk has the lead, I think, not just because she jumped into the race early. She has a lot of support when I was looking at the list of donors from that each candidate has and their demographics. She has a lot of support from liberal Democrats in Seattle and a lot of the folks who want to support a woman of color and not necessarily get involved in messy city council politics, which might be why Gonzalez is trailing her. And something Gonzalez should consider. Gonzalez's contributors include a lot of lawyers, obviously, from her former work as an attorney. And when I say a lot of lawyers, I mean like the vast majority of her large donors are people from who work in law firms. And she seems
that's been true in her city council races as well. So she's drawing on the people who already support her
and who know her. And with whom she may have personal relationships. And she seems to draw a lot of her donations from people of color in the legal profession. What's interesting, I think, is that Bruce Harrell jumped into the race at about the same time as Jessen Farrell, but he's clearly lagging Farrell's fundraising team, or else he's lagging in reporting his donations, whereas the Farrell team is right on top of that. When you look at who's donating to Jessen Farrell, you see some gig economy folks, employees of Amazon, Whole Foods, Facebook, et cetera, as well as a lot of wealthy white liberals like Nick and Leslie Hanauer, employees of Civic Ventures and Brady Walkinshaw. And she's been collecting a ton of smaller donations. Also interesting, as I said before, is Andrew Grant Houston, who's in third place, and he's been positioning himself to the left of the other major candidates. He's third on this list and has raised just a few $1,000s less than Lorena Gonzalez. He's also drawing in donations from lots of employees of tech companies. Now, Farrell has a few tech companies. Houston has a lot of employees of tech companies donating to him. Companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Tableau, Intel, eBay, Adobe, and others. He's also third on the list of candidates in this race with in terms of the number of democracy vouchers collected. Echo Hawk has the most with 8,149 vouchers, far and away the leader. Gonzalez has 3,964, and Houston has 3,400. So clearly going after the vouchers can make a big difference in terms of early fundraising.
So that's exactly how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. So that's what the mayor's race looks like so far. And I wanted to also talk about the open race in City Council Position 9 and what the fundraising looks like in that race, because this is pretty important for how I think this race will play out. Sarah Nelson of the Fremont Brewing Company, who, by the way, is not taking democracy vouchers, she is ahead with $76,864 as of Wednesday. Nikita Oliver is in second place with $67,161, a pretty impressive total for just coming right out of the gate, right? And then
she just announced what, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, not long ago. And Brianna Thomas, Lorena Gonzalez's legislative aide, is trailing in third place with $24,591. And then there's the two minor candidates, a very young Claire Grant just has around $500, and then Rebecca Williamson, the socialist worker, hasn't reported any donations so far. Notably, Sarah Nelson's top contributors include conservative business owners like Ian Eisenberg of Uncle Ike's Pot Shop, one of her first supporters, Michael Dunn of Dunn Lumber, Matt Griffin of Pine Street Group, Judith Runstad of Wright Runstad, and a whole host of real estate developers, private capital, and wealthy investors. So we know, obviously, who her constituency is. And weirdly enough, also Heidi Wills is on this list, which is showing her true colors, I think. Now, 52% of the donations to Sarah Nelson's campaign were donations over $500, right?
Wow.
Yeah, and that's because she's not taking democracy vouchers, so there's no limit there in terms, or there isn't that artificially low limit there in terms of what individuals can give her. And over 75% of her donors gave her more than $200 each. And that's partly, and like I said, that's partly because she's not accepting democracy vouchers. But it's also because a lot of her donors are very wealthy. Now, looking at donations by district, Nelson's donors reside mostly in District 7. That's my district of Queen Anne, Magnolia, you know, South Lake Union, downtown. District 3, and I would guess a lot of her donors are in the wealthy enclaves along Lake Washington and the Ship Canal. And District 4, which is Laurelhurst and the wealthy neighborhoods along Lake Washington north of the Ship Canal. 13% are from outside Seattle, which is pretty typical for other candidates in the race, too. On the other hand, her leading challenger, Nikita Oliver, had about 39% of her contributors give over $200, with nobody giving more than $300 because she's taking democracy vouchers. The largest number of donors to her campaign, about 80% of her total donors, have given less than $100. And yet she's still within less than 10,000 of Nelson's lead. That's pretty amazing.
That's very similar to Sawant's profile when she runs also.
Yeah, but there's a major difference here.
Of course there is.
By district, when you look at it by district, Oliver has the vast majority of these donations coming from District 2 and District 3. That's about 40% of her total, with only about 14% of her contributions from outside Seattle, whereas I think we saw with Sawant a much larger number of her donations from outside the city.
And I'm suspecting that those District 3 donations are not from the same part of District 3 as Nelson.
They're from the rest of District 3 that doesn't line the waterfront. Okay. Now, and then the rest of her contributions are spread evenly between the other districts. So that's pretty remarkable. Now, the middle of the road candidate in this race, which is Brianna Thomas, the legislative aide to Lorena Gonzalez, she's trailing pretty badly in her fundraising. I think that says something kind of interesting about early donors in Seattle. The people who are really passionate about politics in this city are either very progressive or they're very anti-progressive.
And I would also say that that's a major problem for Taylor because she doesn't have the name recognition of the other two candidates.
Exactly.
Nelson has run before, and of course, Nikita Oliver ran for mayor 4 years ago.
And is very well known among activists in Seattle.
And it also means that they could get their campaigns up and running and get their fundraising operations up and running. There's a tremendous advantage in setting up a campaign to having run before.
Yes.
And so I think we're seeing that with Taylor now.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I guess it's not surprising then that the largest amount of contributions to Thomas's campaign come from outside of Seattle, about 28%, which is about double the ratio for the other two candidates. And I think that's because she doesn't have a lot of name recognition in Seattle, so she's having to look at a broader list of people throughout the state, particularly state Democrats, to donate to her campaign. But it could also be that big liberal Democratic donors within the city of Seattle are waiting for another candidate to jump in to this race to represent the kind of the middle for them. And there's still plenty of time for candidates to file. There's still about 7 weeks. The deadline is Friday, May 21st for candidates to file for mayor and city council and city attorney positions for the November elections. So we'll see if anybody else jumps in to run for council position 9. So far, the top two are Nelson and Oliver, and very, very different candidates. And we can really see that. At some point in the future here, probably sometime after the filing deadline is over and we know who all of the candidates are in the different races, we'll look at what each candidate's position is. And we'll talk more about the issues.
Yeah, and a lot of these candidates, especially the minor ones, don't have fully fleshed platforms yet. So
And some of them may drop out as well.
Yeah. So we'll hold off on that. I think a lot of people, I think a lot of people are waiting in terms of donations to the mayor's race. But I want to underscore, we talked about this previously, that, if you have democracy vouchers, don't sit on them. This is not, this is the time when it's most valuable to get those in because it helps campaigns establish themselves. And that's really critical, especially in a citywide race.
Yeah, I mean, look at the coverage that we're giving right now to people's funding. And I'm sure, you know, Nikita Oliver and Justin Farrell and Lorena Gonzalez and Colleen Echohawk, they've been out there just trying to get, and Andrew Grant Houston, they've been out there just trying to get as many democracy vouchers as they can. I wouldn't wait until after May 21st if you see a candidate you like or that you know and that you want to support. Give them your democracy vouchers.
Yeah, I'm sure Alex Zimmerman is trying to collect as many as he can, too.
Well, again, as we touched on earlier in a different show, different episode, the democracy vouchers, of which each person gets four $25 vouchers, you can split those up if you so choose to different candidates in different races. You can send them
and
all
different
your,
times. You don't. You can. You can send in some now and some later.
Yeah.
Some after
and some,
May 21st.
Some people give to more than one candidate in the same race, which is okay too. You might think that that doesn't make sense, but you know, for the primaries, there are two positions available in each race. So sometimes it makes sense to support two candidates.
Two campaigns that get to the general. And in, say, a three-person race, which essentially is what the city council race is now, you might want to, say, make sure that one candidate doesn't advance. So you get to the other two.
Yes.
Just saying
that's a possibility.
All right. So moving on to developments this week in Olympia.
Yeah, just an update on bills that passed the House and the Senate and are headed for reconciliation. There were a few. This is the hard part, the high hurdle that is difficult for most bills to get over. It's generally not that difficult for bills to pass through one chamber, but to pass through both chambers and then head for reconciliation between the two houses and a final vote is a little bit harder. This week, among the bills that I found that there were four bills in particular that I thought were very interesting that passed through the House and the Senate and are headed to reconciliation. And I'm just going to talk about those. There are many, many, many bills that are still alive that have had fiscal notes attached to them in order to give the legislature another week or so to work on them and get them passed. So next week I'm expecting a lot more bills to get passed and head for reconciliation. But the four that passed this week that I thought were interesting include in the House, Senate Bill 5313, the Gender Affirming Treatment Act passed. This would prevent health insurance companies and the state healthcare authority from discriminating against transgender people. They can't deny coverage for sex reassignment surgery or other gender-affirming treatment. State coverage and Medicaid managed care coverage of these benefits will begin January 1st, 2022. That's the Gender-Affirming Treatment Act, and that is looking very good, like it will reach the governor's desk eventually. Senate Bill 5055 requires the Public Employment Relations Commission to appoint arbitrators for police accountability arbitration cases in Washington state. They would develop a roster of 9 to 18 arbitrators, train them, and assign them in alphabetical order to complaint cases. Arbitration decisions would be posted online by the commission, so the public would be able to see the decision. And this would go into effect on January 1st, 2022. It also includes a clause that forbids cities and counties from entering into collective bargaining agreements that would overturn any civilian review bodies or laws enacted by a municipality in the state of Washington.
So let me ask about that, because How can a legislatively passed law overturn a collective bargaining agreement that already exists? Because that exists for SPD and a number of other law enforcement agencies already.
The current SPOG contract is expired.
Oh, that's a good point.
I just want to point that out. Yeah.
Good point.
This clause of Senate Bill 5055, even though the commission would go into effect on January 1st, 2022, this particular clause, I believe, would go into effect 90 days after the end of the legislative session. So, this would put the city of Seattle, and you raise a good point, because it would put the city of Seattle in an interesting position where the Seattle Police Department is working under an expired contract.
And an interim chief.
And and then there's the city council passed law that imposes stricter police disciplinary practices than the expired SPOG contract did. So that's very interesting. I think the city council and the mayor and the interim police chief, as well as the court-appointed monitor, we're going to have to sit down and talk about that. And figure
that would
out,
require Jenny Durkin actually doing her job.
Yeah, wanting to do her job, which I think is the issue. So, that's going to be very interesting at Senate Bill 5055 if you want to go check it out and read it. Passing in the Senate and headed to reconciliation was one bill I thought was very interesting, was House Bill 1151, a COVID relief bill that will allow the state to provide consolidated emergency assistance to needy state residents more than once in a 12-month period during a state of emergency. And it directs the Department of Social and Health Services to update the standards for who qualifies for cash assistance. This is meant to provide additional cash assistance to needy residents of the state of Washington during the COVID pandemic.
And didn't the Democrats in Olympia come out with a proposed budget this week also?
Oh, they did, and I'll get to that.
Okay.
One more bill that
is that had a lot of COVID relief measures in it as well.
Oh yeah, a lot of COVID stuff. Now, one more bill that passed that passed the House and is headed for the Senate. It's a revenue bill. It's House Bill 1277 would create a new program, the Eviction Prevention Rental Assistance Program, within the Department of Commerce. It would also levy a $100 surcharge on recording documents by county auditors to be used for funding affordable housing and homelessness services. Some of that money can be retained by the counties where the fees are collected to use on homelessness services and affordable housing, but some will have to be sent to the state for statewide programs that address those needs. So that was an important bill that passed the House, and because it's revenue related, it's alive and is on the Senate calendar. So then, as Job mentioned, the House and Senate both released their capital budgets early in the week, and then they released their operating budgets. House Bill 1080 is the House's capital budget, which will fund $6.5 billion in improvements in construction, and about $5.7 billion of that are construction projects. It's about 313 pages long. You can read through it if you want. I saw very general summaries of it, not detailed summaries, but here's what was in those very general summaries. About $2 billion of the bill would be for public schools and universities for capital projects there. It allocates about $400 million in federal funding as well for things like water, sewer, and broadband upgrades. About $155 million of that is going to be used to expand broadband to places that don't have it. It spends about $249.5 million for toxic waste cleanup, $175 million will go into the Housing Trust Fund to build affordable housing, and $120.9 million will go for affordable housing and emergency shelters for homelessness into other programs in addition to the Housing Trust Fund. So that's the capital budget, which typically spends money to make capital improvements. House Bill 1094 is the House's state operating budget for 2021 to 2023. The Senate version is Senate Bill 5092. Now, the House's version would spend $58 billion. The Senate's version would spend $59 billion on the state's operating budget. Both of those bills are about 1,000 pages long, so they're quite the tome if you want to flip through them. So I obviously didn't read those, but I did look at some summaries, and here is some of what the state's operating budget, the proposed state operating budget bills contain: about $1.85 billion for schools, K through 12 schools. About $1.185 billion for COVID-19 vaccines, contact tracing, and testing. About $1.07 billion for rental assistance. About $600 million for unemployment tax relief. This is all COVID-19 related. And that $600 million for unemployment tax relief would be to help businesses who saw a huge jump in their unemployment tax rate because of all of the unemployment tax filings. Because of the pandemic lockdown. $340 million in immigrant relief funds, essentially extending unemployment benefits to undocumented workers who have not been able to get any federal assistance. $204.7 million to expand the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act for folks who have had COVID-19 or have had to take care of family members with COVID-19. $166.6 million for mortgage relief for folks who've been struggling to pay their mortgages. $140.8 million for food programs for people who just have not been able to find enough to eat. You know? So there's a lot in there. Most of that, right, that I just outlined were COVID relief related. And as the weeks progress and legislators work hard on the capital budget and the operating budget, there'll be more information about what's in the bill for, you know, kind of standard operation of the state government. But if you go to the Washington State Legislature's website, which is leg.wa.gov, you can see that the only two committees that are meeting today and over the weekend are the House Finance Committee and the House Appropriations Committee and the Senate Ways and Means Committee, which are the two committees that determine, you know, where the money goes, right, and how much money gets spent on anything, right? While Friday was the cutoff for bills to pass both houses if they're not related to the budget, many bills have had a fiscal note attached to them to try to attach them to the budget so that they're still alive. There's a long list of bills that are in committee that will eventually, probably in the next week or so, hit the House and Senate floor and may go up for a vote and pass. So there are a lot of bills still alive, aside from the ones that I've mentioned today. And I just want to say that the next cutoff date is April 2nd, about a week from today. The deadline for fiscal bills to pass out of their committees of origin to the floor of the House and Senate. So that's why there hasn't been a big flurry of voting to push bills out of the House and Senate to conference committee quite yet. There's still just another week, especially if they were able to attach a fiscal note to a bill. So expect a lot of activity and a lot of work late into the day and late into the evening and possibly even overnight on some days.
Even with the longer calendar this year because of the budget, you know, in any given legislative session, they get upwards of 2,000 bills filed. And obviously most of those bills never get this far, but it really tells you what kind of time pressure legislators are under to try and consider, and have their staffs consider, because they can't read all of them by themselves. And get past different pieces of legislation. It really is an incredible grinder. And given the size of our state, I mean, it's not 1889 anymore, and farmers are not coming in during their off season to consider legislation anymore. It's insane that we have a part-time legislature, because it really is a full-time job
that only meets for like 3-4 months of the year. Yeah, it is insane.
Two or three, 60 or 90 day sessions. That's it.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Plus special sessions.
Over time, and we've seen in the last several years that it's pretty routine now that they go over, that they have extended.
Yeah, although since Democrats are controlling both houses, we haven't had that problem, have we?
Quite as much, no. But we still, you know, they still may go an extra week or two, which extends the sessions. I really think we need to be looking at legislators who are full time.
Yes. And we have had to need that for a number of years.
Yeah. Now, if you want to track any of these bills or bills that I've mentioned in prior shows and see whether your bill is still alive and has a fiscal note attached to it, you can always look up the bills by bill number if you go to the state legislature website, leg.wa.gov, and search for bills. Or you can search for bills by subject matter on the Washington State Legislature's website. Click on bill information on the left to look up bills by their bill number or subject matter. On the main page, you'll see the list of committees meeting, and you'll see that it's the House Appropriations and the Senate Ways and Means. And you can watch the committee hearings online. You have to sign up an hour before a committee starts in order to testify. So check them out.
Yeah, that's a great resource.
Yeah, take a look at whether your bill is still alive and has a fiscal note attached to it. Usually you'll see that if it's got a little lowercase f where the bill is listed in committee or on the House or Senate floor.
Yeah, and on the Ways and Means Committee and the Budget Committee, you can find out when those committees are meeting as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Reconciliation, all that.
And reconciliation and all that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to this week's developments regarding COVID.
Yeah, I'm just going to race through these because we've only got about 15 minutes left. Locally, King County numbers have been creeping back up in terms of infections for the last couple of weeks. And this week we saw a statistic that hospitalizations are now up 18%. Over last month, and that is a very disturbing trend, needless to say. Now, what is less clear is how much of that is being driven by more contagious variants, because we know that the British variant and some of the other variants are in King County, and how much of it is being driven simply by people being by reopening, by people being less careful about pandemic precautions. Now is not the time to get careless. We also saw this week the state announcing that it is fully immunized 1 million people, so we should be seeing those vaccination numbers, and that's a particularly disturbing development, and obviously it's a very positive development, but also it means those people are not really in the pool of people to get hospitalized in any significant number. So
I think the number is 1 million doses given, but the number of folks vaccinated in King County is only fully vaccinated is only about 18% of our total population.
Yes, I'm talking about statewide.
Statewide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Statewide they reached 1 million fully vaccinated. The State Department of Health announced that yesterday.
Yeah, I think we've got about 7.6 million residents in Washington state, so yes. Still a long ways from herd immunity.
Yep. And so the other development statewide is that the state announced that they were complying with last week's CDC guideline that kids in reopening schools, that we're talking elementary age kids, only need to stay 3 feet apart rather than 6 feet. So that's the standard that reopening school districts, and you know, I have a hard time imagining.
I guess they're thinking because they're smaller.
Yeah. And I have a hard time imagining, you know, keeping those little bundles of energy any distance from each other as they bounce off each other all day. But, that's just me. So that's local. Nationally, we reached 30 million confirmed cases.
Can I add a little bit to the local?
Sure. Although we have a couple major national stories I want to make sure to get to.
Okay, yeah. On Friday, King County Health Director Dr. Jeffrey Duchan said that new COVID-19 cases have risen 43% in the last 2 weeks. And he said it could be the beginning of a fourth pandemic wave. Washington State entered phase three on March 22nd, which means some restaurants are now serving people at 50% capacity and can seat up to 10 people at a table. And I'm seeing that when I walk around and get my exercise. And I feel like I'm not the only person who must be thinking that that's pretty stupid.
Yeah, I think we are open way too soon.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see where that goes.
That's reflecting.
We also have a huge demand for vaccinations here in King County, at least, but the supply is not meeting the demand. For example, the Lumen Field Event Center in South Seattle is set up to administer 22,000 vaccinations per day, but can only give about 4,000 doses at a time because that's all they're receiving. And appointment slots tend to fill up within 24 hours for the entire week. So that's where we are in terms of vaccination. It's demand far out exceeding supply. So, and then on March 31st, that's next Wednesday, the following people will be eligible to get vaccinated. So they'll be competing for these time slots. People 16 or older with two or more comorbidities or underlying conditions, all people 60 years or older, people in group homes and other congregate living facilities, people in jails and prisons, the homeless, restaurant and food service workers, construction workers, and manufacturing workers. So just saying, yeah. It would be nice to get the supply to meet the demand before we start opening it to more people, but, you know.
Yeah, and also the city announced this week that they're shutting down two testing sites, which is a separate thing, in West Seattle and Rainier Beach and converting them into vaccination sites. So the city is trying to ramp up and offer more vaccination sites to try and meet the demand. But as Maria said, you gotta have the vaccine in order to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be an issue with the state.
Yeah.
No, it seems like a questionable trade-off when we need testing.
Yeah, and our number of people vaccinated seems to be lagging other states nationwide too, which I think is kind of interesting. And I wonder whether that's something with our state's public health officials not being vocal enough. Hey, send us more supply.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the supply does seem to be the issue. And the rollout has been troubled because of the lack of supply. You could excuse that in the first month when it was the Trump administration who was, you know, sending vaccine to Republican states, but that's not the case now, so.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay,
anything
so national?
COVID? Okay.
We got to 30 million confirmed cases nationwide, which didn't even make the news this week. Which tells you how sick people are of the pandemic, I think, and the fact that it was a busy news week with other developments that were completely unrelated, unless you think, you know, people staying indoors for a year has something to do with the mass shootings. But so there was that. What happened there? We have 128 million people vaccinated in the country so far, and that includes over 70% of people over the age of 65. So that's a very encouraging development because that is a significant amount of the overall cases as well. So that should be affecting the numbers going down in almost every state. The 10 worst states, incidentally, per capita for rollout, Washington State is not one of them. They are all Republican states, and most of them are in the South. So this is still a political process, unfortunately. Let's just stop there and move on to other national stories.
Okay.
Let's move on to Georgia, where the Republicans passed a voter suppression bill this week.
Yeah, and it's a doozy. I don't want to go into all of the different facets of it here, but basically every way that the highly imaginative Georgia Republicans have been able to think to discourage black and brown people from voting. It's in the bill. And if you do vote and they don't like the result, they can overturn it. The Republicans in the state legislature anointed to themselves rather than the Secretary of State as the people who would certify an election. And they also reserved to themselves the right to replace the election board in any given county with people of their choosing. Now, since that would include state legislative races, it basically means that Republicans have written into law that they can control who gets elected to the state legislature. If that sounds like a train wreck waiting to happen, it is. If it sounds like something that the Soviet Union probably came up with, it is. And
it sounds to me like a coup, actually.
Yeah, it really is. It's very, very bad. And, you know, they're rolling back early voting hours. They're rolling back you have to show ID in order to turn in an absentee ballot. You can't just mail it in. You know, this thing has so many different provisions. And we're talking a state in the deep south where it gets really hot and humid in the summer.
That was one aspect of the bill that just was appalling to me, that it would criminalize the act of providing food and water to anybody standing in line to vote.
While you're making sure that those lines are hours long.
Yeah.
Because you're reducing polling places as well.
Yeah, it's insane. And you're making it almost impossible to vote by absentee ballot. So I think what the next step is that Democrats in Georgia will have to sue.
No, they already have sued.
Yeah.
They sued. This was passed by the state Senate, the state House, and signed by the governor on Thursday.
Yeah.
They rushed it through quickly.
So the next
and they can
the next
make
step
the text
is
available.
Challenging it in the courts. So.
No, it already has. They ruled out a lawsuit.
But it's not unique because there are 43 states in the United States where Republicans are introducing bills similar to this. This is
including Washington State, although
yes, this is a major drive by the Republican Party to try to end democracy in the United States. So I think it's very clear. People need to be very clear on the direction of the Republican Party these days.
And we have seen this for the last 20 years. Every time the Republican Party loses, and they've lost, you know, 7 of the 8 popular votes for the last presidential elections of going back 30 years. You know, there's this debate about, well, should we try and attract new voters? And the answer is always no. We need to be more radical in order to, in order to be purer, because voters are somehow are supposed to be rejecting us because, you know, we're not pure conservative enough. Well, you know, that rightward trend over the last 30 years has now morphed into open fascism. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's deeply anti-democratic. It's deeply authoritarian. And they've got their dear leader now. And Trump still has a hold on the party. And he's still claiming the last election was stolen from him. And so the solution to this is not to attract more voters. It's to prevent people from voting except for your base. And in this case, the case of Georgia, and I'm sure that provision will be emulated in other states, to reserve to yourself the right to throw out votes that you don't like, or throw out precincts that you don't like, because with computer programs now, and we've seen this with gerrymandering, you can pick who votes. You can pick your voters. You don't have to appeal to voters. You just have to pick them. And that is deeply authoritarian, and we're seeing that, and we're going to see a lot of this tied up in courts, and it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court, and that's the scary part.
All right. Moving on, another mass shooting this week.
Yeah, and I've been looking through local Denver media, and the one piece of that shooting that we don't know about, this was in a grocery store on Monday, and I want to talk about some of the copycats out there who have been arrested this week in different parts of the country, too. But we know that he was a young Syrian immigrant, 21 years old, Had been in this country since he was 3 years old, so wasn't really an immigrant in terms of his own living memories. But he apparently had been picked on in high school up until a couple of years ago when he graduated, and was showing a number of mental illness symptoms. But for some reason, his family kept this to themselves. He didn't seek out treatment. His family didn't seek out treatment for him. He was paranoid. He was delusional. It seems pretty clearly a mental health episode, and very tragic and very random. But we don't know that yet, because the Boulder police have not, the Boulder, Colorado police have not released any information on motive. We don't know why he picked a grocery store 20 miles away from where he lived to open fire. The piece of this has gotten a lot of attention is that the automatic weapon that he used to carry out this massacre was purchased 6 days prior. And that's why the lack of any kind of mental illness record for him is such an issue, because he did pass a background check at that purchase. Now, Colorado is an open carry state. It's a state where you can pass a background check and purchase your weapon on the same day. And so, you know, this weapon of war, basically, is very easy to get in Colorado. All you have to do is pass a background check, which he should not have been able to pass. And this is renewed calls once again coming on the heels of the Atlanta shootings last week. For more gun control legislation, and particularly a national background check standard, which does not currently exist. And of course, you know, getting that passed in the Senate, where Republicans can filibuster, is going to be a challenge. There were a number of other instances this week where would-be mass shooters were arrested and charged. I want to talk about three of them. There was one in Atlanta where yet another 21-year-old white male was arrested, and he was in a Publix grocery store. I think I said Publix for Boulder. It was actually it was called King Super. The one in Atlanta was Publix, which is an East Coast chain. And he had six guns on him. He was wearing body armor. He was basically was charged with I believe threatening a store employee, and it was not a good situation. There was also a person in Lexington, Kentucky who was arrested. He was initially thought to be carrying a bomb, but it turned out he was heavily armed, and again with body armor, and a white guy. And then in Benton Harbor, Michigan, a man was arrested for making threats against Joe online in a right-wing social media site against Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Gretchen Whitmer, who's the governor of Michigan, who you may remember was threatened with a kid. Militia members were charged last year with planning to kidnap and potentially kill her. And so the question is, how many of these are copycats? How many of these are right-wing extremists? And we don't know in a lot of these cases yet, because we haven't seen the full charging documents, and it hasn't gotten a lot of media attention. But it's pretty clear that the right-wing and how much of that is overlap, how much of them are both. So a couple things are clear. One, these are all young white guys. The guy in Michigan, I believe, was 42. The others were in their early 20s. And that included the shooters in Atlanta last week and in Boulder this week. So we seem to have a young white male problem. We seem to have still a right-wing extremist problem. And you've still got Fox News giving a lot of airtime to different interviews with Donald Trump, and he's still stoking that base with claims of stolen elections, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is the sort of thing where we've seen a lot of charges, about 400 charges so far for the January 6th riot. But, you know, the Department of Justice under Merrick Garland can only do so much. They are necessarily reactive, and investigations take time. So we're starting to see some of these arrests by local authorities, but we really need to see the Department of Justice ramping up. And Garland has said that right-wing extremism is his top priority as new attorney general. And we're needing to start to see that.
All right. Well, we're going to have to end it there. But
yeah.
There is always next week.
There is, and we'll be back.